but he could not justify the exorbitant price of drinks in such an establishment, not when he had lost two clients in a single day. He therefore entered the next Starbucks he encountered, found a seat, and heaved his sore leg onto an empty chair while he moodily stirred a large black coffee. The squashy earth-coloured sofas, the tall cups of American froth, the wholesome young people working with quiet efficiency behind a clean glass counter, these, surely, were the perfect antidote to Whittaker's stinking spectre, and yet he would not be driven out. Strike found himself unable to stop reliving it all, remembering. While he had lived with Leda and her son, Whittaker's teenage history of delinquency and violence had been known only to social services in the north of England. The tales he told about his past were legion, highly coloured, and often contradictory. Only after he had been arrested for murder had the truth leaked out from people from his past who surfaced, some hoping for money from the press, some determined to revenge themselves on him, others trying in their own muddled fashion to defend him. He had been born into a moneyed upper-middle-class family headed by a knighted diplomat whom Whittaker had believed until the age of 12 was his father. At that point he had discovered that his older sister, whom he had been led to believe was in London working as a Montessori teacher, was actually his mother. That she had serious alcohol and drug problems, and that she was living in poverty and squalor, ostracized by her family. From this time onward, Whittaker, already a problem child, prone to outbursts of extreme temper, during which he lashed out indiscriminately, had become determinedly wild. Expelled from his boarding school, he had joined a local gang and soon became ringleader, a phase that culminated in a spell in a correctional facility because he had held a blade to a young girl's throat while his friend sexually assaulted her. Aged 15, he had run away to London, leaving a trail of petty crime in his wake, and finally succeeded in tracking down his biological mother. A brief, enthusiastic reunion had deteriorated almost at once into mutual violence and animosity. "Is anyone using this?" A tall youth had bent over Strike, his hands already gripping the back of the chair on which Strike's leg was resting. He reminded Strike of Robin's fiancé, Matthew, with his wavy brown hair and clean-cut good looks. With a grunt, Strike removed his leg, shook his head, and watched the guy walk away, carrying the chair, rejoining a group of six or more. The girls there were eager for his return, Strike could see. They straightened up and beamed as he placed the chair down and joined them. Whether because of the resemblance to Matthew, or because he had taken Strike's chair, or because Strike genuinely sensed a tosser when he saw one, Strike found the youth obscurely objectionable. His coffee unfinished, but resentful that he had been disturbed, Strike heaved himself back to his feet and left. Spots of rain hit him as he walked back along Whitechapel Road, smoking again, and no longer bothering to resist the tidal wave of memory now carrying him along. Whittaker had had an almost pathological need for attention. He resented Leda's focus being diverted from him at any time and for any reason, her job, her children, her friends. And he would turn his flashes of mesmeric charm on other women whenever he deemed her inattentive. Even Strike, who hated him like a disease, had to acknowledge that Whittaker possessed a powerful sex appeal which worked on nearly every woman who passed through the squat. Thrown out of his most recent band, Whittaker continued to dream of stardom. He knew three guitar chords and covered every bit of paper not hidden from him with lyrics that drew heavily on the Satanic Bible, which Strike remembered lying, its black cover emblazoned with a pentagram and goat head combined, on the mattress where Leda and Whittaker slept. Whittaker had an extensive knowledge of the life and career of the American cult leader, Charles Manson. The scratchy sound of an old vinyl copy of Manson's album, Lie, The Love and Terror Cult, formed the soundtrack to Strike's GCSE year. Whittaker had been familiar with Leda's legend when he met her, and liked to hear about the parties she had been at, the men she had slept with. Through her, he became connected to the famous, and as Strike got to know him better, he came to conclude that Whittaker craved celebrity above almost anything else. He made no moral distinction between his beloved Manson and the likes of Johnny Rokeby, rockstar. Both had fixed themselves permanently in the popular consciousness. If anything, Manson had achieved it more successfully, because his myth would not fluctuate with fashion. Evil was always fascinating. However, Leda's fame was not all that attracted Whittaker. His lover had borne children to two wealthy rock stars who provided child support. Whittaker had entered the squat under the clear impression that it was part of Leda's style to dwell in impoverished Bohemia, but that somewhere nearby was a vast pool of money into which Strike and Lucy's fathers, Johnny Rokeby and Rick Fantoni respectively, were pouring money. He did not seem to understand or believe the truth. That years of Leda's financial mismanagement and profligacy had led both men to tie up the money in such a way that Leda could not fritter it away. Gradually, over the months, Whittaker's spiteful asides and jibes on the subject of Leda's reluctance to spend money on him had become more frequent. There were grotesque tantrums when Leda would not fork out for the Fender Stratocaster on which he had set his heart, would not buy him the Jean-Paul Gaultier velvet jacket for which, stinking and shabby though he was, he suddenly had a yen. He increased the pressure, telling outrageous and easily disprovable lies, that he needed urgent medical treatment, that he was £10,000 in debt to a man threatening to break his legs. Leda was alternately amused and upset.
"Darling, I haven't got any dough," she would say. "Really, darling, I haven't, or I'd give you some, wouldn't I?"
Leda had fallen pregnant in Strike's 18th year, while he was applying for university. He had been horrified, but even then, he had not expected her to marry Whittaker. She had always told her son that she had hated being a wife. Her first teenage essay into matrimony had lasted 2 weeks before she had fled. Nor did marriage seem at all Whittaker's style. Yet it had happened. Undoubtedly because Whittaker thought it would be the only sure way to get his hands on those mysteriously hidden millions. The ceremony took place at the Marylebone Registry Office, where two Beatles had previously married. Perhaps Whittaker had imagined that he would be photographed in the doorway like Paul McCartney, but nobody had been interested. It would take the death of his beaming bride to bring the photographers swarming to the court steps. Strike suddenly realized that he had walked all the way to Aldgate East Station without meaning to. This whole trip, he castigated himself, had been a pointless detour. If he had got back on the train at Whitechapel, he would have been well on the way to Nick and Ilse's by now. Instead, he had careered off as fast as he could in the wrong direction, timing his arrival perfectly to hit the rush hour crush on the tube. His size, to which was added the offence of a backpack, caused unexpressed disgruntlement in those commuters forced to share the space with him, but Strike barely noticed. A head taller than anyone near him, he held onto a hand strap and watched his swaying reflection in the darkened windows, remembering the last part. The worst part. Whittaker in court, arguing for his liberty, because the police had spotted anomalies in his story of where he had been on the day that the needle entered his wife's arm, inconsistencies in his account of where the heroin had come from and what Leda's history of drug use had been. A raggle-taggle procession of fellow squat dwellers had given evidence about Leda and Whittaker's turbulent, violent relationship, about Leda's eschewal of heroin in all its forms, about Whittaker's threats, his infidelities, his talk of murder and of money, his lack of noticeable grief after Leda's body had been found. They had insisted over and again, with unwise hysteria, that they were sure Whittaker had killed her. The defense found them pathetically easy to discredit. An Oxford student in the dock had come as a refreshing change. The judge had eyed Strike with approval. He was clean, articulate and intelligent, however large and intimidating he might be if not suited and tied. The prosecution had wanted him there to answer questions on Whittaker's preoccupation with Leda's wealth. Strike told the silent court about his stepfather's previous attempts to get his hands on a fortune that existed largely in Whittaker's own head, and about his increasing pleas to Leda for her to put him in her will as proof of her love for him. Whittaker watched out of his gold eyes, almost entirely impassive. In the last minute of his evidence, Strike and Whittaker's eyes had met across the room. The corner of Whittaker's mouth had lifted in a faint, derisive smile. He had raised his index finger half an inch from the place where it rested on the bench in front of him and made a tiny sideways swiping motion. Strike had known exactly what he was doing. The micro-gesture had been made just for him, a miniature copy of one with which Strike was familiar. Whittaker's mid-air, horizontal slash of the hand, directed at the throat of the person who had offended him. "You'll get yours," Whittaker used to say, the gold eyes wide and manic. "You'll get yours." He had brushed up well. Somebody in his moneyed family had stumped up for a decent defense lawyer. Scrubbed clean, soft-spoken and wearing a suit, he had denied everything in quiet, deferential tones. He had his story straight by the time he appeared in court. Everything that the prosecution tried to pull in to draw a picture of the man he really was, Charles Manson on the ancient record player, the satanic Bible on the bed, the stoned conversations about killing for pleasure, were batted away by a faintly incredulous Whittaker.
"What can I tell you? I'm a musician, Your Honour," he said at one point. "There's poetry in the darkness. She understood that better than anyone."
His voice had cracked melodramatically, and he broke into dry sobs. Counsel for the defence hastened to ask whether he needed to take a moment. It was then that Whittaker had shaken his head bravely and offered his gnomic pronouncement on Leda's death.
"She wanted to die. She was the quicklime girl."
Nobody else had understood the reference at the time, perhaps only Strike, who had heard the song so many times through his childhood and adolescence. Whittaker was quoting from Mistress of the Salmon Salt. He had walked free. The medical evidence supported the view that Leda had not been a habitual heroin user, but her reputation was against her. She had done plenty of other drugs. She was an infamous party girl. To the men in curled wigs, whose job it was to classify violent deaths, it seemed wholly in character that she would die on a dirty mattress in pursuit of pleasure her mundane life could not give her. On the court steps, Whittaker announced that he intended to write a biography of his late wife, then vanished from view. The promised book had never appeared. Leda and Whittaker's son had been adopted by Whittaker's long-suffering grandparents, and Strike had never seen him again. Strike had quietly left Oxford and joined the army. Lucy had gone off to college. Life had carried on. Whittaker's periodic reappearance in the newspapers, always connected with some criminal act, could never be a matter of indifference to Leda's children. Of course, Whittaker was never front-page news. He was a man who had married somebody famous for sleeping with the famous. Such limelight as he achieved was a weak reflection of a reflection.
"He's the turd that won't flush," as Strike put it to Lucy, who did not laugh.
She was less inclined even than Robin to embrace rough humour as a means of dealing with unpalatable facts. Tired and increasingly hungry, swaying with the train, his knee aching, Strike felt low and aggrieved, mainly at himself. For years he had turned his face resolutely towards the future. The past was unalterable. He did not deny what had happened, but there was no need to wallow in it. No need to go seeking out the squat of nearly 2 decades ago, to recall the rattling of that letterbox, to relive the screams of the terrified cat, the sight of his mother in the undertaker's, pale and waxen in her bell-sleeved dress.
"You're a fucking idiot," Strike told himself angrily, as he scanned the tube map, trying to work out how many changes he would have to make to get to Nick and Ilse's. Whittaker never sent the leg. You're just looking for an excuse to get at him.
The sender of that leg was organized, calculating, and efficient. The Whittaker he had known nearly two decades previously had been chaotic, hot-headed, and volatile. And yet,
you'll get yours. She was the quicklime girl.
Fuck! Said Strike loudly, causing consternation all around him. He had just realized that he had missed his connection. Chapter 11. Feeling easy on the outside, but not so funny on the inside. Blue Oyster Cult, this ain't the summer of love. Strike and Robin took turns tailing Platinum over the next couple of days. Strike made excuses to meet during the working day and insisted that Robin leave for home during daylight hours when the tube was still busy. On Thursday evening, Strike followed Platinum until the Russian was safely back under the ever-suspicious gaze of Two Times, then returned to Octavia Street in Wandsworth, where he was still living to avoid the press. This was the second time in his detective career that Strike had been forced to take refuge with his friends Nick and Ilse. Theirs was probably the only place he could have borne to stay, but Strike still felt strangely undomesticated within the orbit of a dual-career married couple. Whatever the drawbacks of the cramped attic space above his office, he had total freedom to come and go as he pleased, to eat at 2 a.m. when he had come in from a surveillance job, to move up and down the clanging metal stairs without fear of waking housemates. Now, he felt unspoken pressure to be present for the occasional shared meal, feeling antisocial when he helped himself from the fridge in the small hours, even though he had been invited to do so. On the other hand, Strike had not needed the army to teach him to be tidy and organized. The years of his youth that had been spent in chaos and filth had caused an opposite reaction. Ilse had already remarked on the fact that Strike moved around the house without leaving any real mark on it, whereas her husband, a gastroenterologist, might be found by the trail of discarded belongings and imperfectly closed drawers. Strike knew from acquaintances back in Denmark Street that press photographers were still hanging around the door to his office, and he was resigned to spending the rest of the week in Nick and Ilse's guest room, which had bare white walls and a melancholy sense of awaiting its true destiny. They had been trying unsuccessfully for years to have a child. Strike never inquired as to their progress, and sensed that Nick, in particular, was grateful for his restraint. He had known them both for a long time. Ilse for most of his life. Fair-haired and bespectacled, she came from St. Moore's in Cornwall, which was the most constant home that Strike had ever known. He and Ilse had been in the same primary school class. Whenever he had gone back to stay with Ted and Joan, as had happened regularly through his youth, they had resumed a friendship initially based on the fact that Joan and Ilse's mother were themselves old schoolmates. Nick, whose sandy hair had been receding in his 20s, was a friend from the comprehensive in Hackney, where Strike had finished his school career. Nick and Ilse had met at Strike's 18th birthday party in London, dated for a year, then split up when they went off to separate universities. In their mid-20s they had met again, by which time Ilse was engaged to another lawyer and Nick dating a fellow doctor. Within weeks, both relationships were over. A year later, Nick and Ilse had married, with Strike as best man. Strike returned to their house at 10:30 in the evening. As he closed the front door, Nick and Ilse greeted him from the sitting room and urged him to help himself to their still plentiful takeaway curry.
"What's this?" he asked, looking around,
disconcerted at long lengths of Union Jack bunting, many sheets of scribbled notes, and what looked like 200 red, white and blue plastic cups in a large polythene bag.
We're helping organise a street party for the royal wedding, said Ilsa.
Jesus Christ almighty, said Strike darkly,
heaping his plate with lukewarm madras.
It'll be fun. You should come.
Strike threw her a look that made her snigger.
Good day,
asked Nick, passing Strike a can of Tennent's.
No,
said Strike, accepting the lager with gratitude.
Another job cancelled. I'm down to 2 clients.
Nick and Ilsa made sympathetic noises, and there followed a comradely silence while he shoveled curry into his mouth. Tired and dispirited, Strike had spent most of the journey home contemplating the fact that the arrival of the severed leg was having, as he had feared, the effect of a wrecking ball on the business he had been working so hard to build up. His photograph was currently proliferating online and in the papers in connection with a horrible, random act. It had been a pretext for the papers to remind the world that he was himself one-legged, a fact of which he was not ashamed, but which he was hardly likely to use in advertising. A whiff of something strange, something perverse, was attached to him now. He was tainted.
Any news about the leg? Asked Ilsa.
Once Strike had demolished a considerable amount of curry and was halfway down the can of lager.
Have the police got anything?
I'm meeting Wardle tomorrow night to catch up, but it doesn't sound like they've got much. He's been concentrating on the gangster.
He had not given Nick and Ilsa details about 3 of the men he thought might be dangerous and vengeful enough to have sent him the leg. But he had mentioned that he had once run across a career criminal who had previously cut off and mailed a body part. Understandably, they had immediately taken Wardle's view that he was the likely culprit. For the first time in years, sitting on their comfortable green sofa, Strike remembered that Nick and Ilsa had met Jeff Whittaker. Strike's 18th birthday party had taken place at the Bell Pub in Whitechapel. His mother was by this time 6 months pregnant. His aunt's face had been a mask of mingled disapproval and forced jollity, and his Uncle Ted, usually the peacemaker, had been unable to disguise his anger and disgust as a patently high Whittaker had interrupted the disco to sing one of his self-penned songs. Strike remembered his own fury, his longing to be away, to be gone to Oxford, to be rid of it all. But perhaps Nick and Ilsa would not remember much about that. They had been engrossed in each other that night, dazed and amazed by their sudden, profound mutual attraction.
"You're worried about Robin," said Ilsa, more statement than question.
Strike grunted agreement, his mouth full of naan bread. He had had time to reflect on it over the last 4 days. In this extremity, and through no fault of her own, she had become a vulnerability, a weak spot. And he suspected that whoever had decided to readdress the leg to her had known it. If his employee had been male, he would not currently feel so worried. Strike had not forgotten that Robin had hitherto been an almost unqualified asset. She was able to persuade recalcitrant witnesses to speak when his own size and naturally intimidating features inclined them to refuse. Her charm and ease of manner had allayed suspicion, opened doors, and smoothed Strike's path 100 times. He knew he owed her. He simply wished that right now she would bow out of the way, stay hidden until they had caught the sender of the severed leg.
"I like Robin," said Ilsa.
"Everyone likes Robin,"
said Strike thickly, through a second mouthful of naan. It was the truth. His sister Lucy, the friends who called in at the office, his clients, all made a point of telling Strike how much they liked the woman who worked with him. Nevertheless, he detected a note of faint inquiry in Ilsa's voice that made him keen to make any discussion of Robin impersonal, and he felt vindicated when Ilsa's next question was, "How's it going with Ellen?"
"All right," said Strike.
"Is she still trying to hide you from her ex?"
asked Ilsa, a faint sting in the inquiry.
"Don't like Ellen, do you?" said Strike,
taking the discussion unexpectedly into the enemy camp
for his own amusement. He had known Ilse on and off for 30 years. Her flustered denial was exactly what he had expected.
I do like, I mean, I don't really know her, but she seems... Anyway, you're happy, that's what counts.
He had thought that this would be sufficient to make Ilse drop the subject of Robin. She was not the first of his friends to say that he and Robin got on so well, wasn't there a possibility, hadn't he ever considered? But Ilse was a lawyer, and not easily scared away from pursuing a line of questioning.
Robin postponed her wedding, didn't she? Have they set a new...
Yeah, said Strike. 2nd of July. She's taken a long weekend to go back to Yorkshire and do whatever you do for weddings. Coming back on Tuesday.
He had been Matthew's unlikely ally in insisting that Robin take Friday and Monday off, relieved to think that she would be 250 miles away in her family home. She had been deeply disappointed that she would not be able to come along to the old Blue Last in Shoreditch and meet Wardle, but Strike thought he had detected a faint trace of relief at the idea of a break. Ilse looked slightly aggrieved at the news that Robin still intended to marry someone other than Strike. But before she could say anything else, Strike's mobile buzzed in his pocket. It was Graham Hardacre, his old SIB colleague.
Sorry, he told Nick and Ilse, setting down his plate of curry and standing up. Got to take this, important. Hardy!
Can you talk, Oggy?
Asked Hardacre, as Strike headed back to the front door.
I can now, said Strike,
reaching the other end of the short garden path in 3 strides, and stepping out into the dark street to walk and smoke.
What have you got for me?
To be honest, said Hardacre, who sounded stressed, it'd be a big help if you came up here and had a look, mate. I've got a warrant officer who's a real pain in the arse. We didn't get off on the right foot. If I start sending stuff out of here and she gets wind of it.
And if I come up?
Make it early in the morning and I could leave stuff open on the computer. Carelessly, you know.
Hardacre had previously shared information with Strike that, strictly speaking, he ought not to have done. He had only just moved to 35 section. Strike was not surprised that he did not want to jeopardize his position. The detective crossed the road, sat down on the low garden wall of the house opposite, lit a cigarette and asked,
"Would it be worth coming up to Scotland for?"
"Depends what you want."
"Old addresses, family connections, medical and psychiatric records couldn't hurt. Brockbank was invalided out. What was it, 2003?
"That's right," said Hardacre.
A noise behind Strike made him stand and turn. The owner of the wall on which he had been sitting was emptying rubbish into his dustbin. He was a small man of around 60, and by the light of the street lamp, Strike saw his annoyed expression elide into a propitiatory smile as he took in Strike's height and breadth. The detective strolled away, past semi-detached houses whose leafy trees and hedges were rippling in the spring breeze. There would be bunting soon, to celebrate the union of yet another couple. Robin's wedding day would follow not long after.
"You won't have much on Lang, I suppose,"
Strike said, his voice faintly interrogative. The Scots' army career had been shorter than Brockbank's.
"No, but Christ, he sounds a piece of work," said Hardacre. "Where'd he go after the glasshouse?"
The glasshouse was the military jail in Colchester, where all convicted military personnel were transferred before being placed in a civilian prison.
"HMP Elmley. We've got nothing on him after that. You'd need the probation service."
"Yeah,"
said Strike, exhaling smoke at the starry sky. He and Hardacre both knew that he was no longer any kind of policeman. He had no more right than any other member of the public to access the probation service's records.
"Whereabouts in Scotland did he come from, Hardy?"
"Melrose. He put down his mother as next of kin when he joined up. I've looked him up."
"Melrose," repeated Strike thoughtfully.
He considered his 2 remaining clients, the moneyed idiot who got his kicks trying to prove he was a cuckold, and the wealthy wife and mother who was paying Strike to gather evidence of the way her estranged husband was stalking their sons. The father was in Chicago, and Platinum's movements could surely go uncharted for 24 hours. There remained, of course, the possibility that none of the men he suspected had anything to do with the leg, that everything was in his mind.
A harvest of limbs.
How far from Edinburgh is Melrose?
About an hour, hour and a half's drive.
Strike ground out his cigarette in the gutter.
Hardy, I could come up Sunday night on the sleeper, nip into the office early, then drive down to Melrose, see whether Lang's gone back to his family, or if they know where he is.
Nice one. I'll pick you up at the station if you let me know when you're getting in, Oggy. In fact, Hardacre was gearing himself up for an act of generosity. If it's only a day trip you're after, I'll lend you my car. Strike did not immediately return to his curious friends and his cold curry. Smoking another cigarette, he strolled around the quiet street, thinking. Then he remembered that he was supposed to be attending a concert at the South Bank Centre with Ellen on Sunday evening. She was keen to foster an interest in classical music that he had never pretended was more than lukewarm. He checked his watch. It was too late to ring and cancel now. He would need to remember to do so next day. As he returned to the house, his thoughts drifted back to Robin. She spoke very little about the wedding that was now a mere 2.5 months away. Hearing her tell Wardle about the disposable wedding cameras she had ordered had brought home to Strike how soon she would become Mrs. Matthew Cunliffe.
There's still time, he thought.
For what? He did not specify. Even to himself. Chapter 12. The Writings Done in Blood. Blue Oyster Cult, OD'd on life itself. Many men might think it a pleasant interlude to receive cash for following a pneumatic blonde around London, but Strike was becoming thoroughly bored of trailing Platinum. After hours hanging around Horton Street, where the LSE's glass and steel walkways occasionally reveal the part-time lap dancer passing overhead on her way to the library, Strike followed her to Spearmint Rhino for her 4 p.m. shift. Here he peeled away. Raven would call him if Platinum did anything that passed for untoward, and he was meeting Wardle at 6. He ate a sandwich in a shop near the pub, chosen for their rendezvous. His mobile rang once, but on seeing that it was his sister, he let the call go to voicemail. He had a vague idea that it would soon be his nephew Jack's birthday, and he had no intention of going to his party. Not after the last time, which he remembered mainly for the nosiness of Lucy's fellow mothers and the ear-splitting screams of overexcited and tantruming children. The old blue last stood at the top of Great Eastern Street in Shoreditch, a snub-nosed, imposing three-story brick building curved like the prow of a boat. Within Strike's memory, it had been a strip club and brothel. An old school friend of his and Nick's had allegedly lost his virginity there to a woman old enough to be his mother. A sign just inside the doors announced the old blue last's rebirth as a music venue. From 8 o'clock that evening, Strike saw, he would be able to enjoy live performances from the Islington Boys Club, Red Drapes, In Golden Tears, and Neon Index. There was a wry twist to his mouth as he pushed his way into a dark wood-floored bar, where an enormous antique mirror behind the bar bore gilded letters advertising the pale ales of a previous age. Spherical glass lamps hung from the high ceiling, illuminating a crowd of young men and women, many of whom looked like students, and most dressed with a trendiness that was beyond Strike. Although she was in her soul a lover of stadium bands, his mother had taken him to many such venues in his youth, where bands containing her friends might scrape a gig or two before splitting up acrimoniously, reforming, and appearing at a different pub 3 months later. Strike found the old blue last a surprising choice of meeting place for Wardle, who had previously only drunk with Strike in the Feathers, which was right beside Scotland Yard. The reason became clear when Strike joined the policeman, who was standing alone with a pint at the bar.
The wife likes Islington Boys Club. She's meeting me here after work.
Strike had never met Wardle's wife, and while he had never given the matter much thought, he would have guessed her to be a hybrid of platinum, because Wardle's eyes invariably followed fake tans and scanty clothing. And the only wife of a Met policeman that Strike knew, whose name was Helly, and who was primarily interested in her children, her house, and salacious gossip. The fact that Wardle's wife liked an indie band of whom Strike had never heard, notwithstanding the fact that he was already predisposed to despise that very band, made him think that she must be a more interesting person than the one he had expected.
"What have you got?" Strike asked Wardle, having secured himself a pint from an increasingly busy barman.
By unspoken consent, they left the bar and took the last free table for two in the place.
"Forensics are in on the leg," said Wardle as they sat down. "They reckon it came off a woman aged between mid-teens and mid-twenties, and that she was dead when it was cut off, but not long dead, looking at the clotting. And it was kept in a freezer in between cutting it off and handing it to your friend Robin."
Mid-teens to mid-twenties. By Strike's calculations, Brittany Brockbank would be 21 now.
"Can't they be any more precise on the age?"
Wardle shook his head. "That's as far as they're prepared to go. Why?"
"I told you why. Brockbank had a stepdaughter."
"Brockbank," repeated Wardle, in the noncommittal tone that denotes lack of recall.
"One of the guys I thought might have sent the leg," said Strike, failing to conceal his impatience. "Ex-desert rat, big dark guy, cauliflower ear. Yeah, all right," said Wardle, immediately nettled.
"I get past names all the time, pal. Brockbank. He had the tattoo on his forearm."
"That's Lang," said Strike. "He's the Scot I landed in jail for 10 years. Brockbank was the one who reckoned I'd given him brain damage."
"Oh, yeah."
"His stepdaughter, Brittany, had old scarring on her leg. I told you that."
Yeah, I remember." Strike stifled a caustic retort by sipping his pint. He would have felt far more confident that his suspicions were being taken seriously had it been his old SIB colleague Graham Hardacre who sat opposite him, rather than Wardle. Strike's relationship with Wardle had been tinged from the first with wariness and latterly with a faint competitiveness. He rated Wardle's detective abilities higher than those of several other Met officers whom Strike had run across, but Wardle still regarded his own theories with paternal fondness that he never extended to Strike's.
"So, have they said anything about the scarring on the calf?"
"Old. Long predated the death."
"Jesus fuck," said Strike.
The old scarring might be of no particular interest to forensics, but it was of vital importance to him. This was what he had dreaded. Even Wardle, whose habit it was to take the mickey out of Strike on every possible occasion, appeared to be experiencing something like empathy at the sign of the detective's concern.
"Mate," he said, and that too was new. "It's not Brockbank, it's Mally."
Strike had been afraid of this, afraid that the very mention of Mally would send Wardle careering after him to the exclusion of Strike's other suspects, excited at the thought of being the man who put away so notorious a gangster.
"Evidence?" Strike said bluntly.
Haringey Crime Syndicate's been moving Eastern European prostitutes around London and up in Manchester. I've been talking to Vice. They bust into a brothel up the road last week and got two little Ukrainians out of there. Wardle dropped his voice still lower. "We've got female officers debriefing them. They had a friend who thought she was coming to the UK for a modelling job and never took kindly to the work, even when they beat the crap out of her. Digger dragged her out of the house by her hair 2 weeks ago and they haven't seen her since. They haven't seen Digger since either."
"All in a day's work for Digger," said Strike. "That doesn't mean it's her leg. Has anyone ever heard him mention me?"
"Yes," said Wardle triumphantly. Strike lowered the pint he'd been about to sip. He had not expected an affirmative answer.
"They have?"
"One of the girls Vice got out of the house is clear she heard Digger talking about you not long ago."
"In what context?"
Wardle uttered a polysyllable. The surname of a wealthy Russian casino owner for whom Strike had indeed done some work at the end of the previous year. Strike frowned. As far as he could see, Digger, knowing that he had worked for the casino owner, made it no more likely that Digger had found out that he owed his previous stretch of incarceration to Strike's evidence. All Strike took from this fresh information was that his Russian client moved in extremely insalubrious circles, something of which he had already been aware.
"And how does me taking Arzamatsev's coin affect Digger?"
"Well, where do you want to start?" said Wardle, with what Strike felt was vagueness masquerading as the wide view. "The syndicate's got fingers in a lot of pies. Basically, we've got a guy you've crossed with a history of sending people body parts, and he disappears with a young girl right before you get sent a young girl's leg."
"You put it like that, it sounds convincing," said Strike, who remained entirely unconvinced. "Have you done anything about looking at Lang, Brockbank and Whittaker?"
"Course," said Wardle. "Got people trying to locate all of them." Strike hoped that was true, but refrained from questioning the statement on the basis that it would jeopardize his friendly relations with Wardle. "We've got CCTV of the courier as well," said Wardle.
"And?"
"Your colleague's a good witness," said Wardle. "It was a Honda. Fake plates, clothes exactly as she described. He drove off southwest, heading towards a real courier depot as it goes. Last time we caught him on camera was in Wimbledon. No sign of him or the bike since, but like I say, fake plates. Could be anywhere."
"Fake plates," repeated Strike. "He did a hell of a lot of planning."
The pub was filling up all around them. Apparently the band was going to play upstairs. People were squeezing towards the door that led to the first floor, and Strike could hear the familiar scream of microphone feedback.
"I've got something else for you," said Strike, without enthusiasm. "I promise Robin I give you copies."
He had returned to his office before daybreak that morning. The press had given up trying to catch him going in or out, though an acquaintance in the guitar shop opposite informed him that photographers had lingered until the previous evening. Wardle took the two photocopied letters, looking mildly intrigued.
"They've both come in the last couple of months," said Strike. "Robin thinks you should take a look."
"Want another?" he asked, gesturing to Wardle's almost empty glass. Wardle read the letters while Strike bought two more pints. He was still holding the note signed R.L. when he returned. Strike picked up the other one and read, in clearly legible, rounded, schoolgirlish writing, "That I will only be truly me and truly complete when my leg is gone. Nobody gets that it isn't and never will be part of me. My need to be an amputee is very hard for my family to accept. They think it's all in my mind, but you understand."
"You got that wrong," thought Strike,
dropping the photocopy back onto the tabletop and noting as he did so that she had written her address in Shepherd's Bush as clearly and neatly as possible, so that his reply, advising her on how best to cut off her leg, would be in no danger of going astray. It was signed Kelsey, but with no surname. Wardle, still deep in the second letter, let out a snort of mingled amusement and disgust.
"Fucking hell, have you read this?"
"No," said Strike. More young people were squeezing into the bar. He and Wardle were not the only people in their mid-30s, but they were definitely at the older end of the spectrum. He watched a pretty pale young woman, made up like a 40s starlet, with narrow black eyebrows, crimson lipstick, and powder blue hair pinned into victory rolls, look around for her date.
"Robin reads the Nutter letters and gives me a pricey if she thinks I need one."
"I want to massage your stump," read Wardle aloud. "I want you to use me as a living crutch.
Holy shit, that's not even physically..."
He flipped over the letter. "R.L. Can you read that address?"
"No," said Strike, squinting at it.
The handwriting was dense and extremely difficult to read. The only legible word in the cramped address on a first read was Walthamstow.
"What happened to
I'll be by the bar, Eric.
The young woman with the pale blue hair and crimson lips had appeared at the table beside them, holding a drink. She wore a leather jacket over what looked like a 40s summer dress.
Sorry, babes, talking shop, said Wardle, unperturbed. April, Cormor and Strike, my wife, he added.
Hi, said Strike, extending a large hand. He would never have guessed Wardle's wife looked like this. For reasons he was too tired to analyze, it made him like Wardle better.
Oh, it's you,
said April, beaming at Strike, while Wardle slid the photocopied letters off the table, folded and pocketed them.
Cormor and Strike, I've heard lots about you. Are you staying for the band?
I doubt it, said Strike, though not unpleasantly. She was very pretty.
April seemed reluctant to let him go. They had friends joining them, she told him, and sure enough, within a few minutes of her arrival, another six people turned up. There were two unattached women in the group. Strike allowed himself to be talked into moving upstairs with them, where there was a small stage and an already packed room. In response to his questions, April revealed that she was a stylist who had been working on a magazine shoot that very day, and, she said it casually, a part-time burlesque dancer.
Burlesque!
Repeated Strike at the top of his voice, as microphone feedback again screeched through the upper room to shouts and groans of protest from the assembled drinkers. Isn't that arty stripping? He wondered, as April shared the information that her friend Coco, a girl with tomato-red hair who smiled at him and wiggled her fingers, was a burlesque dancer too. They seemed a friendly group, and none of the men were treating him with that tiresome chippiness that Matthew exhibited every time he came within Strike's orbit. He had not watched any live music in a long time. Petite Coco had already expressed a desire to be lifted up so she could see. However, when the Islington Boys Club took to the stage, Strike found himself forcibly transported back to times and people he strove not to think about. Stale sweat in the air, the familiar sound of guitars being tweaked and tuned, the humming of the open mic. He could have borne them all, had the lead singer's posture and his lithe androgyny not recalled Whittaker. Four bars in and Strike knew he was leaving. There was nothing wrong with their brand of guitar-heavy indie rock. They played well, and in spite of his unfortunate resemblance to Whittaker, the lead singer had a decent voice. However, Strike had been in this environment too often and unable to leave. Tonight, he was free to seek peace and clean air, and he intended to exercise that prerogative. With a shouted farewell to Wardle and a wave and a smile to April, who winked and waved back, he left, large enough to carve an easy path through people already sweaty and breathless. He gained the door as the Islington Boys Club finished their first song. The applause overhead sounded like muffled hail on a tin roof. A minute later, he was striding away with relief into the swishing sound of traffic.
Chapter 13. In the presence of another world. Blue Oyster Cult. In the presence of another world. On Saturday morning, Robin and her mother took the ancient family Land Rover from their small hometown of Masham to the dressmakers in Harrogate, where Robin's wedding dress was being altered. The design had been modified because it had initially been made for a wedding in January and was now to be worn in July.
"You've lost more weight,"
said the elderly dressmaker, sticking pins down the back of the bodice.
"You don't want to go any thinner. This dress was meant for a bit of a curve."
Robin had chosen the fabric and design of the dress over a year ago. Loosely based on an Ellie Saab model that her parents, who would also be forking out for half of her elder brother Stephen's wedding in 6 months' time, could never have afforded. Even this cut-price version would have been impossible on the salary Strike paid Robin. The lighting in the changing room was flattering, yet Robin's reflection in the gilt-framed mirror looked too pale, her eyes heavy and tired.
She was not sure that altering the dress to make it strapless had been successful. Part of what she had liked about the design in the first place had been the long sleeves. Perhaps, she thought, she was simply jaded from having lived with the idea of the dress for so long. The changing room smelled of new carpet and polish. While Robin's mother, Linda, watched the dressmaker pin, tuck and twitch the yards of chiffon, Robin, depressed by her own reflection, focused instead on the little corner stand carrying crystal tiaras and fake flowers.
"Remind me, have we fixed on a headdress?"
asked the dressmaker, who had the habit of using the first-person plural so often found in nursing staff.
"We were leaning towards a tiara for the winter wedding, weren't we? I think it might be worth trying flowers with the strapless."
"Flowers would be nice," Linda agreed from the corner of the dressing room. Mother and daughter closely resembled each other. Though her once slender waist had thickened and the faded red-gold hair piled untidily on top of her head was now laced with silver, Linda's blue-grey eyes were her daughter's, and they rested now upon her second child with an expression of concern and shrewdness that would have been comically familiar to Strike. Robin tried on an array of fake floral headdresses and liked none of them.
"Maybe I'll stick with a tiara," she said.
"Or fresh flowers," suggested Linda.
"Yes," said Robin, suddenly keen to get away from the carpet smell and her pale, boxed-in reflection. "Let's go and see whether the florist could do something."
She was glad to have the changing room to herself for a few minutes. As she worked her way out of the dress and pulled her jeans and sweater back on, she tried to analyze her low mood. While she regretted that she had been forced to miss Strike's meeting with Wardle, she had been looking forward to putting a couple of 100 miles between her and the faceless man in black who had handed her a severed leg. Yet she had no sense of escape. She and Matthew had rowed yet again on the train coming north. Even here, in the changing room in James Street, her multiplying anxieties haunted her. The agency's dwindling caseload, the fear of what would happen if Strike could no longer afford to employ her. Once dressed, she checked her mobile. No messages from Strike. She was almost monosyllabic among the buckets of mimosa and lilies a quarter of an hour later. The florist fussed and fiddled, holding blooms against Robin's hair and accidentally letting drops of cold, greenish water fall from the long stem of a rose onto her cream sweater.
"Let's go to Betty's," suggested Linda, when a floral headdress had at last been ordered.
Betty's of Harrogate was a local institution, the spa town's long-established tea room. There were hanging flower baskets outside, where customers queued under a black golden glass canopy, and within were tea canister lamps and ornamental teapots, squashy chairs, and waitresses in brodery anglaise uniforms. It had been a treat to Robin, ever since she was small, to peer through the glass counter at rows of fat marzipan pigs, to watch her mother buying one of the luxurious fruitcakes laced with alcohol that came in its own special tin. Today, sitting beside the window, staring out at primary coloured flower beds, resembling the geometric shapes cut out of plasticine by small children, Robin declined anything to eat, asked for a pot of tea, and flipped over her mobile again. Nothing.
"Are you all right?"
Linda asked her.
"Fine," said Robin. "I was just wondering if there was any news."
"What kind of news?"
"About the leg," said Robin. "Strike met Wardle last night, the Met officer."
"Oh," said Linda, and silence fell between them until their tea arrived. Linda had ordered a fat rascal, one of Betty's large scones. She finished buttering it before she asked,
"You and Cormoran are going to try and find out who sent that leg yourselves, aren't you?"
Something in her mother's tone made Robin proceed warily.
"We're interested in what the police are doing, that's all."
"Ah," said Linda, chewing, watching Robin. Robin felt guilty for being irritable. The wedding dress was expensive, and she had not been appreciative.
Sorry for being snappy.
That's all right.
It's just Matthew's on my case all the time about working for Cormoran.
Yes, we heard something about that last night.
Oh, God, Mum. I'm sorry.
Robin had thought they'd kept the row quiet enough not to wake her parents. They had argued on the way up to Massam, suspended hostilities while having supper with her parents, then resumed the argument in the living room after Linda and Michael had gone to bed.
Cormoran's name came up a lot, didn't it?
I assume Matthew's...
He's not worried, said Robin.
Matthew determinedly treated Robin's work as a kind of joke, but when forced to take it seriously, when, for instance, somebody sent her a severed leg, he became angry rather than concerned.
Well, if he's not worried, he should be, said Linda.
Somebody sent you a part of a dead woman, Robin. It's not so long ago that Matt called us to say you were in hospital with concussion.
I'm not telling you to resign, she added,
refusing to be cowed by Robin's reproachful expression.
I know this is what you want.
Anyway,
she forced the larger half of her fat rascal into Robin's unresisting hand.
I wasn't going to ask whether Matt was worried. I was going to ask whether he was jealous.
Robin sipped her strong Betty's Blend tea. Vaguely, she contemplated taking some of these tea bags back to the office. There was nothing as good as this in Ealing Waitrose. Strike liked his tea strong.
Yes, Matt's jealous, she said at last.
I'm assuming he's got no reason.
Of course not, said Robin hotly.
She felt betrayed. Her mother was always on her side. Always.
There's no need to get fired up, said Linda, unruffled. I wasn't suggesting you'd done anything you shouldn't.
Well, good, said Robin, eating the scone without noticing it.
Because I haven't. He's my boss, that's all.
And your friend, suggested Linda, judging by the way you talk about him.
Yes, said Robin, but honesty compelled her to add, it's not like a normal friendship, though.
Why not?
He doesn't like talking about personal stuff. Blood out of a stone.
Except for one notorious evening, barely mentioned between them since, when Strike had got so drunk he could hardly stand, voluntary information about his private life had been virtually non-existent.
You get on well, though?
Yeah, really well.
A lot of men find it hard to hear how well their other halves get on with other men.
What am I supposed to do? Only ever work with women?
No, said Linda. I'm just saying, Matthew obviously feels threatened.
Robin sometimes suspected that her mother regretted the fact that her daughter had not had more boyfriends before committing herself to Matthew. She and Linda were close. She was Linda's only daughter. Now, with the tea room clattering and tinkling around them, Robin realized that she was afraid that Linda might tell her it wasn't too late to back out of the wedding if she wanted to. Tired and low though she was, and in spite of the fact that they had had several rocky months, she knew that she loved Matthew. The dress was made, the church was booked, the reception almost paid for. She must plough on now and get to the finishing line.
I don't fancy Strike. Anyway, he's in a relationship. He's seeing Ellen Toft. She's a presenter on Radio 3.
She hoped that this information would distract her mother, an enthusiastic devourer of radio programs while cooking and gardening.
Ellen Toft? Is she that very beautiful blonde girl who was on the telly talking about romantic composers the other night? Asked Linda.
Probably, said Robin, with a pronounced lack of enthusiasm, and in spite of the fact that her diversionary tactic had been successful, she changed the subject.
So, you're getting rid of the Land Rover?
Yes, we'll get nothing for it, obviously. Scrap, maybe.
Unless, said Linda, struck by a sudden thought. You and Matthew want it. It's got a year's tax left on it, and it always scrapes through its MOT somehow.
Robin chewed her scone, thinking. Matthew moaned constantly about their lack of car, a deficiency he attributed to her low salary.
Her sister's husband's A3 cabriolet caused him almost physical pangs of envy.